You know, actually, at the risk of being provocative, and especially as we're thinking about the graduate students coming forward, and more and more women are graduate students, particularly in the biological sciences, and more moving into the faculty ranks, although fewer and fewer. I think team science is really the kind of thing that women have always done. This is the way women work. And in fact, when Brian Utsi and Luis presented their science paper at the IRC team meeting several years ago, what they showed was an increase in teamwork over time by going to the Web of Science and identifying all these cognitive artifacts, peer review papers, et cetera, and showing that it's really been a dramatic increase. And I went to them afterwards and told them, I thought that that was being diluted by the fact that most of it was dominated by male-based science, where there's always a dominant structure. There's a hierarchy. And in fact, even Howard, in the prenuptial analogy that you used, it's based on a dominant structure, that there is a dominant person, generally a male, in the environment that's making all the money, so you have to have the prenuptial. Of course, there are many women who also do this, so I'm not trying to be completely judgmental here. But the notion is that I said to Brian, if we actually threaded out the women, my guess would be, my hypothesis was that there wouldn't be a slope in the way women did work. In fact, we've always been collaborative. We've always been team-based. And so we just finished a study, and unfortunately, Marta wasn't able to fly in, and I couldn't present yesterday. But what we did was we started by looking at websites with departments to identify who look like women and who look like men. And there's a lot in that statement, but let's leave it at that. And so what we found was, and we went back 30 years, and we asked who was collaborating and when did they become collaborative. And Brian and Luis said, nope, it's all going to be this increased slope. And I said, nope, it's going to be like this. Guess which way it was? It's like this. And in fact, women don't learn to be collaborative. They're only not collaborative in five different departments for the first 5 years of their training. As soon as they get out of training, what do? They collaborate. And so there's an interesting part of what's going on as we say that team science is in its infancy. It's really just that you're learning to work in the way women have always worked. And And I also think the hierarchical structure that is a part of the academy is a gender specified way of working. Thus, if we start working in the way women typically do, without barriers, without in many ways to look at a very flat structure, and there's a lot of work on that side of the equation, I think we're going to be far further down the path. Rather than saying team science is a new idea, I think it's just the dominant group of people within science to date are now learning to work in a new way. And for the graduate students who are coming in, where we now have in some cases 70% and 80% female graduate students, at some level this is intuitive to them, and I don't want to teach them that this is something new. I want you to, for them to come and say, well, the way I would ordinarily work is go to my bench partner and say, well, how could we get this to work together? Or how could we go and clean the freezer today together? Or how could we engage a social scientist together? And again, I think at the risk of being provocative, the data are really pretty clear that this is not a field in its infancy. This is a field that is learning to work in the way women have always worked.
Thank you.
Thank you, Terry. And on that note, this is a call to action. I'm not qualified to do the set of studies, but some of you might be. And both the National Institutes of Health and the National Science Foundation have funding mechanisms that support research on gender and folks who go into science. And so if what Teresa's just provoked in you really stirs you, and now you just need to know how to get that funded, come talk to me, and we'll figure out how we can get that important issue.
Okay, Holly, I'll be there tomorrow.
Okay.
Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you again.
Jack Pladsowitz from Research Corporation for Science Advancement. First, a comment on Howard's talk, a brief comment, then a question for Mike. The comment, I think, codifies some of the ideas of conflict at the end. It comes from a book. I don't remember the author. The title is memorable. The book was written for the business environment to deal with people who are very corrosive, and the title of the book was "The No Blank Hole Rule." You can fill in the blank, but the quote was in terms of avoiding corrosive people in teamwork, and the rest was, When you're in this teamwork process and trying to come to consensus, argue as if you know you're right. Listen as if you know you're wrong. And when the decision is made by consensus, quit arguing and get behind it. So I think that sort of gets at the sense of what you were, some of the things you were saying, Howard. Mike knows that the Research Corporation has for a long time focused on early career scientists and trying to help them with very risky, innovative work early in their careers and get them started, sort of validating their first ideas. So my question for Mike is, as these teams, as the magnitude of teamwork has really being escalated, really rising up fastly, especially I think with the funding by the Department of Energy of these of research centers, which really are very, very large enterprises, the $120 million centers you were talking about, either in parallel with or in concert with existing ongoing energy laboratories around the world, around the country rather. Historically, we have sort of a mechanism for bringing new people into the system. But these are sort of the major leagues. The metaphor, I guess, is baseball. How is the minor league situation? How do you bring in new ideas and new talent? Will it be different from the older system? Will it be just a matter of incorporating colleagues? And you know, obviously, the obvious standard methods are postdoctoral students of yours and your colleagues and graduate students and the new people that you hire. Do you see any other mechanisms, any new mechanisms that will relate more to team-based, large team efforts like the ones you've described? We're interested in that because we think that that's a niche where we have a lot of interest in helping advance these early career people.
Well, Jack, that's a very good question because one of the aspects of all of these centers that comes into play is how you get young faculty members who are currently present to be engaged in these centers. And at Northwestern, it's been fairly effective with regard to being able for the centers to be able to fund at least partially students, postdocs for young faculty in order to get them engaged in the center's activities. And it's done a couple of things simultaneously. It's number one, frequently introduced the young faculty member to a new direction. And number two, provided them with resources that they probably would not have gotten in any other way just because of the fact that they have no track record. And so it really provides a nice catalyst for getting people engaged in a particular field. And I think all team science-based enterprises need to be sensitive to that way of working because I've seen this happen in numerous cases where the young faculty really benefit greatly from, in some cases, association with even three or four centers. And some of our more entrepreneurial young faculty who want to diversify their research portfolios engage in a lot of this activity. And as a consequence, it's from our standpoint, flipping it around, from the center standpoint, it's important to have resources that are available to help this out. And certainly from other indicators like from your organization, for instance, it would be interesting if, in fact, organizations that were in the business, essentially, of helping young faculty could coordinate or in some way with the centers so that the centers could be more effective in doing this. And in fact, even under certain circumstances, develop programs that were tied together in some way in order to promote young faculty participation in given broad areas that were already well established with regard to center funding, so to take full advantage of the resources that are available.
Yeah, that's terrific. We have a program that that we're funding now in solar energy research, a very small program on the dollar level compared to what you're talking about. But really, we hope to vet some really innovative ideas of very early career people and then hope to connect them with people at the other labs. Nate Lewis, as you probably know, has worked with us on our review mm-hmm. panel and a number of others who are in the community, the solar energy right. community. And we really hope that with that conference that we will hold annually in the fall called Scilog Conference, Science and Dialogue, at the Biosphere, by the way, at the north of Tucson. So we're going to make use of that center in a different way than it was historically. We hope to sort of make these connections between mm-hmm. people with really, really creative ideas very early in their career, probably unable to mount the kinds of centers you're talking about, either independently or maybe even being brought in as the principals in a major team, to sort of have their ideas crack in with with a multiple level of other organizations from industry and from other research centers. So we'll be. I sure hope you can consider our invitation to. Which we're going to be issuing now very soon to these future conferences to other people at the energy centers. And I think it would be a great opportunity for both the early career people that we fund as well as the centers to see some talent very early in a little bit different perspective than might see them in the more traditional ways. But thanks a lot. It's a great conference, and wish you luck with the proposal for the big one.
Hi, I'm Jack Pincus with Silicon Technologies. I have two quick questions, one for Howard and one for Mike. So for Howard, the prenuptial agreement that you described describes a process used in the corporate world for strategic partnerships, mm-hmm. various types of collaborations, and other interbusiness arrangements. Often the agreements that are written are fairly detailed and describe many aspects of the collaboration or partnership to avoid any misunderstanding as it goes along. People who generally draft these agreements or organize them have many years' experience and have developed a lot of know-how in navigating the waters. What sort of support is provided for researchers who are new at the process in developing what you call a prenuptial agreement?
Our first attempt, modeled after the work done in the Army Corps of Engineers, looked very much like the kind of agreements that you're talking about and looked very much like a contract. It was not met with overwhelming enthusiasm by the scientists at NIH, but we did work with them to refine it and to put it in an acceptable form. We have more extensive sets of questions that we can draw from, and we're available to work with people at NIH in crafting an agreement that's tailored specifically to their needs for the particular collaboration. But we're not in a position to do that for the extramural community.
I didn't expect you would. Scientists typically reject that sort of arrangement,
yes.
Although it'll be interesting to see if there is a conflict that develops under these agreements, how it proceeds, and whether there is any problem by not having a formal agreement.
We have had good luck with that, because every contract that gets done, people talk about how they will address disagreements should they arise.
Okay, and for Mike, you've got a very interesting model, and I too wish you luck in getting the grant. How do you propose to deal with the fact that you've got investigators at different institutions, some remote, even 35 miles can be considered remote, in sharing information, sharing data, doing joint analysis of data, and communicating?
Well, actually, we're experiencing that directly already with the Answer Center, and we solved it in a couple of different ways. First of all, with Answer, most of our teams are regional, except with the one exception that's at Yale. And what we do is we do video conferencing on a regular basis with the Yale team, and they actually show up in person about once every 3 or 4 months. And so you need to balance the video conference with actual in-person contact, which is extremely valuable. So too, we send our students for short periods of time to various locations. So the exchange of students helps cement the relationship as well. When you go with a more broadly based consortium, then this, of course, is amplified. And the model that we've adopted for the innovation hub is, because of the requirements of the call, much of the work will have to be done at this one physical location, but that will not preclude work being done in individual laboratories. So what we envision there is individual investigators having people who are both at home and who are stationed at the hub, and perhaps rotating those investigators periodically. And that augmented by electronic communications of the highest order available today, basically. So that investment will be part of that portfolio.
Thank you.
So my apologies when I'm in my regular seat for the rest of the conference. I'm able to stop people from getting in line and standing. We're going to have time in this session for just one additional question. My apologies for those of you who've been standing and waiting. Save those, though, because we'll have lots of networking opportunity time. So we'll let you be the last question.
Hi, I'm John Sexton from Vanderbilt University. I wanted to just make a quick comment about what Howard had said about the joy sort of inherent to these successful scientific collaborations. And just as somebody who just finished graduate school and who had been working in an interdisciplinary scientific team and doing some other things outside of graduate school, it gave me some two different perspectives. I just want to share a little different perspective like we've been talking about in a story, and then I do have a quick question. So,
Make the story short, John.
Okay. I think that many people got into science in the first place because of that joy of discovery and wanting to understand things and discover new things. And I think very often when we start to do science, we almost sort of overtly deny ourselves that pleasure by taking sort of the negative approach of trying to disprove things and saying this won't work and this won't work. And it seems especially prevalent in a team interdisciplinary kind of environment when you have experts from different fields who are trying to come together and work together, and very often they're used to being right, they're used to being the one that knows how everything works, and now all of a sudden you have a bunch of experts from different disciplines that are trying to communicate with each other and listen to one another. And so one of my questions for you is just, you know, experience about how to navigate that. And then just the other real quick aside is that kind of this you know, cooperation thing and joy of discovery thing that I've had the privilege to experience outside of science is through about 10 years working in the world of improvisational theater, which is basically thrives solely on collaboration and bringing groups together, people learning how to listen, communicate, find common ground, and things like that. There is some scientific precedent for this. In 2008 in Switzerland, before they switched on the Large Hadron Collider, the physicists at CERN had some high-profile sort of people from the improv theater world come and do workshops for the physicists, because you have people from all over the world, very highly educated, different perspectives, working on this machine that some feared could blow up the world. And so, you know, the stakes were fairly high, and getting people to collaborate and listen to one another's ideas and work on something like that, I think that was successful. So I just wondered, are there any thoughts on sort of looking outside of the sciences for ways to facilitate, you know, people's capacity to collaborate?
Actually, there are some ways, even within the sciences. Daniel Kahneman, who won the Nobel Prize for Economics 4 or 5 years ago, a behavioral scientist, has done a series of papers about the notion of adversarial collaboration. And in each of those papers, what he's done is identified in the literature people with whom he has ongoing disagreements, approached them and said, this is a foolish way to, you know, do our work. We should get together and collaborate, design a set of experiments that will allow us to explore the differences between us and see if we can better understand them and perhaps come to some kind of common understanding. I highly recommend people take a look at his papers.
Were those collaborations successful?
Yes. Yes. And there's a whole format for doing the publishing, and sometimes some other people have even played with having a mediator for a scientific collaboration between disagreeing people. Mm-hmm. So there are some interesting things to look at. Improv theater is used by a lot of people who do public policy collaboration as part of their training and warm-up. Daniel Kahneman, K-A-H-N-E-M-A-N. Sorry.
And just the last thing I would add, that if you're a scientist looking to better learn how to collaborate and work with other people in an interdisciplinary team in your city, find a level one improv class, you know, take it for 6 weeks, cost you a couple $100. It's a lot of fun and hopefully give you a new skill set. So
thank you very much, everyone.